Jim and Anne, they've got a very interesting headstone on their graves at Helensburgh. Jim died after Anne, and he had the choice of putting the epitaph on the grave, and I think it's pretty well known. For Anne's side, it says, "Here lieth the body of my lovely dear wife Anne, who plays the poker machines whenever she can." And on his side, he said, "Here lie the bones." They called him Uncle Jim. He sits and drinks while she puts his money in. And I've never known what motivated him to write that, whether he was a little bit resentful of the amount of money that Anne put through the poker machines. But I must tell you that they had a really good relationship. A really good, loving relationship. And there was never any animosity that I ever saw between them. And it was... that upbringing for me was just wonderful. It was... to the time I got to 16, I didn't have much interest in learning, I guess, or like to be scholarly. But I certainly had an interest in all the things that were around me, the bush and the ocean and the fish and so on, but all at a sort of a general interest level, not at a academic level. I think that might have perhaps come a bit later. Yeah. When National Park took over in 1975, they forced us to sign a license agreement which said that on the death of the occupant or the licensee, and we're only allowed to put one name on the license initially, or through default of paying rent, that the shack would be demolished. And we lost, up to 1990, I think we lost about five shacks, either through the death of the owner or a couple of them didn't pay the rent. Now, the rent at that time was, I think initially it was $5 per week. It wasn't much by today's standards, but we still had people who didn't pay it. Either they couldn't afford it, and it's perhaps a reflection on the type of community that was at Bulga. They were not not well off in a sense, but they were not, they didn't miss out on anything. What they had, generally they shared, and they still do today. It's quite an interesting exercise, or it has been for me, to go back through and look at the history of the ownership, and now with the Trove Historic Newspaper Project through the National Library, being able to go back and pull out little bits and pieces that relate to the history of the cabin communities. It's been really good. Now, there are, just on that, and talking about the cabin communities, there are four of them, four coastal cabin communities in the Royal National Park. At Little Geary, there are 20 shacks. At Era, there's around about 93. At Burning Palms, I think it's about 26. And at Bulga, we've got 55, plus four boat sheds and a safety shack where we keep a bit of safety gear. Yeah, so all the shacks now are currently licensed, or still licensed, to National Parks and Wildlife. And the three northern communities have got state heritage listing. Bulga is not. And the reason for that is that when Parks did a conservation management plan for the four communities, they did that in 2001, the draft was put out for public exhibition and then taken back into Parks for adjustment. But they didn't just adjust it, they took to it with a chainsaw and a scalpel. They took out a lot of significant words, individual words, but they also chainsawed out of it a lot of pages and paragraphs. They really diminished the document, or the statements in the document. So that was endorsed in July 2005, and I started to take an interest in the history of the area. And when I read through the new document and saw what they'd taken out of it, I was initially I was shocked, but in another way I was spurred on to continue the research and just see, try to get an understanding of what the real history of the shack areas were. Now, it's my belief that the very basis of a state heritage listing should be a proper conservation management plan. And I say unashamedly that the conservation management plan as it stands today is a fraudulent document. It was so heavily altered, yet it retained a lot of the errors that were in the original draft, and it actually introduced more. So whoever did it was obviously not familiar with the communities, and I've said that Robert Mugabe would be really proud of what Parks did to our conservation management plan. When it came up for state heritage listing, the other communities pushed for it. They actually engaged their own consultant. We were offered an opportunity to join them, and we said no. We would really think that the basis of state heritage listing should be the conservation management plan, and we would not be joining an application to state heritage listing until a proper plan was prepared. And I just heard just recently that may happen, which would be really good. I think that the person who did the original editing of the draft plan should be counselled as well, because what they did, as I say, it was quite shocking. And we don't accept stuff like that in Australia. Yeah, that sort of got me going. I started to read things like George Orwell, 1984, and I could see a real parallel in it. I think that, it was really, for me, a groundbreaking introduction into what governments or representatives of governments will do when they are not happy with something. Yeah, so we've chosen it now. If something comes out, I read it very carefully and try and look for evidence to support what's being said. What else can I tell you about Bulga? In the from the research in the early days, as I say, families were very poor, and I've got a couple of photographs there which you can see from the dress of the people that they weren't well off. But the story is, and the interviews that I did with some of the older people, a couple of them now passed on, was that to say that they didn't feel as though they were poor. They never did without. There was always something for them. They never went hungry. They were well loved. Everybody else was the same. If there was any hardship, the community would pull together to assist the person who or people who are in trouble. And I can see that that has flowed through to where we are today. Yeah. The Bulga community are rather unique too, as far as the other communities go. The people from Bulga and some of the people from the other communities are Helensburg people. So, and it's quite interesting when you look at the backgrounds of those people. The men, in the majority, worked at the mine, and the women worked at the various industries around Helensburg. So in the early days, from 1945 onwards, when women started to work during and after the war, there was a clothing factory at Helensburg, and a lot of the women from the families of Bulga worked at the clothing factory. So you have this situation where people were working together. They were playing together in the local sports and so on. And they drank together at the local clubs and so on. And they also went to Bulga and they shared their recreation time together. So I think that's perhaps a little bit unique. It's not been fully explored. It certainly wasn't explored in the conservation management plan, although it was hinted at. I've built up associations with people that I would never be able to build up in everyday community. I now live at Guymere, and although I'm on speaking terms with a lot of people, I don't have a very close association with them like I do at Bulga, and I'm really, I guess in a sense, proud to be part of that. I'm a little bit different to the men who worked at the mine. I started at a colliery at Helensburgh in 1966 as an electrician. I was sponsored by BHP to go to TAFE and got my engineering certificate, which allowed me to get my electrical engineering certificate of competency as a mine electrical engineer. It's a state government thing. It's not a tertiary qualification, but it was a document that allowed me to go to Appin in the early 1970s for 2 years, first as assistant to the engineer there, I was on training, and then to be the engineer in charge at Appin Colliery for a year, and then the job came back up at Helensburgh, and I went back there, and I worked there for 28 years as the engineer in charge. So I was part of the staff, and a lot of the Bulga people I associated with were, well, you know, coal mines alike, they weren't the enemy, but there were some pretty controversial times, but I always stayed part of the community at Bulga, and was always part of the community at Bulga. I must say, at times I was a little bit on the side, but yeah. Now, what else can I tell you about Bulga? The research into the history of the area has been great. I went down to Canberra a few years ago to have a look at one of the interviews that yourself had done with Richard Dare, who was a shack owner at Werong. Now, I can't ever remember meeting Richard, but I did phone him after I'd been to Canberra to have a chat to him about what he'd written, and it was a great interview. I think there were several half-hour sessions, and he had a really interesting and full life at Werong Beach with his dad. His dad, if I can say, took his own life in about 1967-68. At that time, he was under threat of being thrown out of Werong. Parks in 1966 had just taken over the area, and they had given eviction notices to all the shack owners there. And a couple of the shacks had been burnt out, and the suspicion had been sort of thrown on people who might have had a Parks background of doing that. And it was a very tense situation. And around the Christmas of 1967, we believe that's when it happened, Dick Dare, who was actually Raymond Dare, took his own life down at the beach. But it's, to me, besides the tragedy, it was also, on reflection, shows who the strength of association that people have with place. Now, it looks like Richard Dare went there in the 1940s, and he'd only been there for not less than 30 years, but in that time he'd come to be part of his life, and his children were brought up there. I can see parallels with my feelings for Bulga, and the feelings of others for Bulga, and those feelings come to the fore at times when Parks had threatened to kick us out, which they actually initially did in 1975, before they took over officially in 1976. They put notices on our doors to say that we had 12 months to get out, and it was only through negotiation with the Labor Party Minister for Lands, Bill Crabtree, that we were able to turn that around, and we're able to stay, and here we are. We've been, since we went on the licence in 76, just not quite 40 years. at the end of this year, we will be at the end of 1976, we signed a license early 1977. We're going to be up for 40 years. So. And I'm third generation Bonga person. I've got children and grandchildren now, so there's fifth generation. But we've got a young lad down there now who's a seventh generation Bolga boy. And they're fast breeders down there, but his ancestors were going to Bolga in the late 1800s. And we've been able to trace that through. We've got photographs of the family down there, of the original great-great-great-grandma. And it's really good. And, you know, I had access to a lot of those photos and so on. 20 years ago, I'd saw them and hadn't... I'd looked at them but hadn't really looked into them. And now when I see photos like that, I find them great interest. You look at the photo and you look at the dress and you... knowing the history, you start to understand what it was all about. Quite satisfying, wasn't it? Yeah.
Do you want to tell us about what you have in your shack now?
Right, well, I've got bunks. I've got a double bed and four single bunks. Not there, sorry. There are two double single bunks. So it's the shack sleeps six. In the early days, we had a cot, so it would have slept seven, the baby. Those days are long gone. The grandchildren don't look like they're ready to start anything too soon, so we'll have to wait on that. I've got a gas stove, and my lighting is solar. Refrigerator is now electric. I've got a kerosene fridge, a Charles Hope brand refrigerator in the shack, but it doesn't work anymore. It's a kerosene fridge. It's a little bit of history about that as well. When I took over the shack in 75, the Boyles who owned the shack, and Joe, he worked for a furniture store at Helensburg. And a lady came in the 1950s and said to him, would you trade in a kerosene fridge for an electric fridge, which was all the go then in the 1950s. They were selling off refrigerators, power to the town, and Joe told me, I said to her, what brand fridge is it? And she said to him, it's a Charles Hope. And he said, I said to her, yes, madam, we'll trade that in for you. And I can't remember if he told me how much he paid for it. But he said to me, I always wanted a Charles Hope fridge because it was just a little bit better than the Silent Nights, or a bit more stylish than the Silent Nights or the Kelvinators that the other shack owners had. And that I can remember that fridge going down in about the mid to maybe late 1950s. And had pride of place in the shack. I'd since it was working quite well when I took over, but I mean, it's probably now 70 years old, the fridge. I would like to convert it to solar, but it's a very heavy fridge and it's going to be a matter of getting it back by boat to one of the ramps. I don't want to do away with it because it's from a historic point of view and aesthetics of the shack, it's an important bit of equipment in the shack. I've got I've got a kitchen cabinet which a lot of people drool over. It's lead glass windows and lead glass on the doors, three separate compartments in it. It was in the shack when I first went there, and now when we do our heritage days and people come in the shack, the ladies will say, oh, look at that, you know. it's quite good. I've got solar hot water. I had a system which was a gravity-fed system that went for about 30 years, with very little maintenance. It finally fell over onto the solar panel, so in the last few years I've got another solar panel, and I put the tank on the ground, and I use a solar panel, electric panel, to connect to a pump. So when the sun comes out, it heats the water and it starts the little solar pump, and it circulates the water through the tank. And it works quite well in summer, but it's a bit cool in winter. I've got some ideas to try and fix that. Yeah, the size of the shack, it's 20 foot wide by 18 feet deep, so 6 and a bit meters wide, and around 6 meters deep. It's a fair bit of fibro in it. I've not wanted to disturb it. It's painted and well protected, the fibro, so there's a little bit of demonising going on with fibro at the moment, or in the last few years, but I don't see it as being a problem where I am at Bulga. And just maintenance from time to time. I've had termites in and had to replace timber and so on, but the majority of the shack is not lined, so if termites were to get in, I'd pretty quickly see, you know, where the problem was and be able to replace the timber. But touch wood, I've not had a problem for about 10 years with termites.
Well, do you want to conclude the interview? You've certainly covered almost everything.
Yeah, Edie, I guess I'm 70 years of age. You know, I was born in January 1946. I think I've still got a few years left in me. And in that time, I'd be hoping to continue on with the research into the history of the Bulga community and the other communities. I've got an interest in the Royal National Park in general. At the moment, I'm currently the chair of Friends of Royal National Park. It's an organisation with a lot of people who have a love of the park and advocate for the proper management and maintenance of features of the park, and also the wonderful natural features of the park. We don't want to see people locked out of the park. We'd like to see them provided for in a way that they have minimal impact on the park. Yeah. I'm currently researching history of fatalities in the coal mines in the Southern Division of New South Wales. I've been at that for some time. I've added 130-odd names to the known lists, and I've really got to get my finger out there and finalise that. It's taking up a bit of time. I'm in the Australian Plant Society. I'm in the Sutherland Group, which is a wonderful group of people who they're not only interested in native plants, but a whole range of different things, and I've had some great times with them in recent years, trips away, and just improving my knowledge of plants and so on within the, particularly within the park, and the environment that I'm in at Bulga. So, yeah, as I say, I had perhaps a simple childhood, and I like to think that well, I'm paying for that now. I'm instead of going into retirement, I'm now working. I used up all my free time when I was young. Now I'm starting to pay for it.
Well, thank you very much, John. It was a wonderful interview. Would you donate this to the New South Wales State Library and the local studies library in Wollongong?
Yes, Edie. No,
thanks.
No problem at all.
Okay. Mm.